And now I want to introduce Robert Miller, who will be talking to us about some very important material that has to do with the very heart and soul of today's program. Robert Miller is the Sandra Day O'Connor, is professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law in Arizona. And he is an expert in Indian legal matters, federal law, American Indian and international law, and American Indian economic development and natural resources. He's enrolled as a citizen of the Eastern Shawnee tribe, and he will be talking about a book that he has written. His book talks about makes the case that Thomas Jefferson used the discovery principles in conceiving and launching Lewis and Clark expedition with the goal of securing the Northwest for America. And he establishes the idea that American concept of manifest destiny developed from the legal principles and elements of the doctrine of discovery. Robert, would you please come forward?
Thank you very much. If you know me, I like to be funny. I like to tell a joke, so let's go to lunch. Jan, how long should I talk? I had an hour and 15 minutes. Okay. And my pointer has gone. Here it comes. Okay, now, to get serious, of course, I also want to thank the original owners of these lands for allowing us to be here. The first time I have seen that explicated by indigenous peoples was when I was in Australia in 2010 speaking at some various conferences about the subject today, the doctrine of discovery, and very emphasized there the value of recognizing the lands of where we're at now. So we are also lucky to be living today and on the lands of the original inhabitants. I also want to thank Jan and everyone here at Ecumenical Ministries that was involved with inviting me here. It's brave and important to talk about these subjects, and I want to thank you for being here, for taking the time to think about these things, because these are sometimes ugly things to think about. But it's impossible to ignore what really happened and what the law is and our history and how we arrived at today. American history did not begin in 1607 when the English settlers landed at Jamestown. Thousands of years since time immemorial, indigenous peoples have lived here, lived on the lands, and we need to understand how have we ended up with tribes only 1% of the United States today. 1% of the 50 states of the United States today are owned by tribes. How'd that happen? So that's what I'm going to talk about, the doctrine of discovery. But I want to start with a question to keep you awake. What was the founding father's favorite scripture? Now, I'm not going to answer that until we get to the end, so you must stay awake. And you must think about the founding father's favorite scripture. Okay, whoever gets the answer right gets a free used copy of my book. A free used copy. Okay, so truly, how long should I try to? Okay. So where am I? I'm going to start with discussing the religious justifications that were used for the doctrine of discovery. So maybe you've never even heard of that phrase, but it's American law. It's still United States law today. And so as a law professor, I'm going to talk about the law, and we're going to then look at the history and see the religious justifications that are behind what we call the doctrine of discovery today. And I'm going to start with Johnson v. McIntosh. I've been teaching federal Indian law both at Lewis and Clark. Here I am, a native Oregonian. I was born here and just went to Phoenix 3 years now to teach at Arizona State. When you teach federal Indian law, you start with this case. This is the first case in which the United States Supreme Court addressed at some length Indian legal issues. And it was all about what did indigenous peoples own in their lands. Did they own what you and I know of, or maybe if you're not a lawyer, you don't know this, but we own the fee simple title to our land. When you buy a house, you purchase what's known under Anglo-American property law You are the fee simple absolute owner of your property. And the simple question this case had to decide is, are Indian tribes the fee simple absolute owners of their lands? Do they hold the full title and right in their properties? And the answer in this case was no. Tribes were not the fee simple absolute owners of their land. And in fact, today, folks, when you hear the phrase trust land, that alone means that an Indian tribe or an Indian individual who owns trust land is not the full-fledged fee simple absolute owner. The United States is the legal owner of trust lands. So tribes in the lower 48 states own 56 million acres of land. But they own and hold that land in trust. The United States is the legal owner. The tribe is the beneficial owner. Individual Indians in the lower 48 states own 11 million acres of land in trust. What does that mean again? The United States is the legal owner of that land. The Indian and the Indian family, the native person, is only the beneficial owner. To sell that land, to lease that land, to develop that land, the tribe or the Indian has to ask the permission of the United States. Now, where did that come from? The doctrine of discovery. Chief Justice John Marshall, as you know, probably our most famous Chief Justice, wrote this opinion. You'll notice you're looking, gee, is Johnson an Indian name? Is McIntosh an Indian name? There was no Indian involved in this litigation at all. This land was in what was known as the Indiana Territory, which is now Illinois and Indiana. And this was a dispute between two Americans over who owned a piece of land. I think I have a pointer here. Mr. Johnson had acquired his land through inheritance from his grandfather, who had bought the lands at issue directly from chiefs out in the forest, allegedly. Mr. McIntosh, however, bought the land from the United States, who had signed a treaty with these particular tribes, the Piankashaw peoples and the Illinois tribes. And he then acquired his title to this same piece of property through a purchase from the United States. And so, after many years, they end up in federal court. Who really holds the fee title? And the United States Supreme Court question was, do Indian tribes own the fee simple absolute title so that those chiefs in the woods could have sold the land to Mr. Johnson's grandfather? And I want to tell you something that's fairly interesting about this. The purchase by Mr. Johnson's grandfather had occurred in 1773 and 1775, before there was a United States. So this case is really about what was the law under the English colonial system. What was the law internationally under which indigenous peoples hold their lands? And so let me just say something else. This case is extremely influential and important worldwide, too. This case has been cited by Canadian courts more than 60 times, by Australian courts more than 50 times, by New Zealand courts more than 40 times. In fact, this court was cited in New Zealand, this case was cited in New Zealand in 1847. Discussing what the Maori peoples owned in their property there. The English Privy Council, which is truly sort of the Supreme Court of England, cited this case three times in the 1880s in deciding cases about Africa and Canada. So this is the leading case worldwide to define what rights indigenous peoples held and still hold today in their lands. That's why I started out with discussing what is trust property, what can tribes do with their lands when they're trust lands. They're only the beneficial owner. They cannot sell it, lease it, or develop it without the permission of the United States. That is not fee simple absolute ownership. So this is not just an interesting old relic of American history. This is modern day Indian law and restrictions on individual Indians today. So what is the doctrine of discovery? I have just three points, and I'm not going to, you know, if we were in my law class, I'd be asking you questions now. Have you read the case? Well, okay, let's start talking about it. Mostly we just ask questions. We don't say anything. What is the doctrine of discovery? Well, this is what Chief Justice Marshall said. This continent, North America, what's now the United States, was settled on discovery and conquest. So I love the title of this conference. I forget who came up with it. We had several conference calls talking about this at great length. But whoever came up with this title, it's fantastic. The Gospel. Well, that's a loving thing, right? Jesus of conquest. Wow. What a dichotomy. But John Marshall in the court agrees. Back then, there were only 7 people on the Supreme Court. 7-0. This country, this continent was settled on discovery and conquest. What did that do to Native peoples? Tribal governments, immediately, without their consent, without their knowledge, and without any payment, magically lost some of their property rights. Real property is the word for land, real estate. We're talking about land rights. So the court opined and held, and it's still law today, that the tribes magically lost the full ownership of the land when Europeans showed up with their flag. And oh, what's that other thing they stuck in the soil? Their cross. You've seen those paintings. What's the caption to most of those paintings? Oh, Columbus is thanking God for a safe voyage across the ocean, or Balboa, or Magellan, or you name them what they were doing. Well, they no doubt were glad they got to terra firma, right? But they were engaged in a legal, formalistic ritual to claim the land for their king, their flag, and their religion, their God. What else did tribes lose magically and without their permission? Some of their sovereign powers. And then this is what practically the rest of my law, my class on federal Indian law is about. What do the federal courts, what does the Supreme Court, what does Congress say? What powers and sovereign rights do tribal governments still have to govern their territories and govern the people who come there? But that's not what we're really focusing on today. So we're talking about the doctrine of discovery and the justifications for it. Where did it come from? Well, Chief Justice John Marshall did not make this up. This was well-known law among the founding fathers, discussed in my book. I figured, Pat, you mentioned that. So I had 2 chapters on Thomas Jefferson and his understanding of the doctrine of discovery and his application of the doctrine of discovery. Don't forget, he was a lawyer. He was one of the good guys, right? Hey, you can always tell the lawyer wearing a tie, right? No one else here's got a tie. But how did Thomas Jefferson understand the doctrine of discovery, and what is the doctrine of discovery? So in my book, I break it down into the 10 elements, and we're going to use these elements in a minute to trace how I argue that manifest destiny, what we call American manifest destiny, comes directly from this doctrine of discovery, and the same ethnocentric, ethno-European justifications, and yes, religious justifications. So I'm going to go through these pretty quickly. A first discovery, the first European to show up, that's what the flag and the cross were about. But boy, you pull those out of the sand, that doesn't leave much proof you were there, does it? Oh, so writing stuff on trees, marking trees up, leaving lead plates. Do you know that when Meriwether Lewis and William Clark went across the country, he carried a branding iron with him? Do you know the branding iron is at the Oregon Historical Society if you want to see it? Do you know that when he got out here, they started branding the trees and rocks cliffs? Do you know when they were at Fort Clatsop, they left a written memorial in the fort and gave it to the chiefs and said, if any other white man shows up, give him this piece of paper. What was the piece of paper? The United States has been here. This party of people crossed the continent, stayed here at the mouth of the Columbia River. We're the first. So this fight to prove you were the first went on continually. Captain James Cook, do you know him? His 3 round-the-world voyages. The English Admiralty ordered him wherever he went to leave signs and marks of your occupation and your possession of this area. So they were involved in legal claims, international law legal claims. So first discovery was important. Discovering a new spot first wasn't enough to make it belong to England or France or Spain or Holland or Russia or etc. You had to come back within a reasonable length of time and actually occupy the location. Ah, this is why President Thomas Jefferson was so excited when John Jacob Astor said he was going to come out to the mouth of the Columbia River and build Fort Astoria. Jefferson was still the president in 1808, and when Astor tells him I'm going to build a trading post out there, Jefferson writes, and I can quote, "I will give you all the support the executive can provide," period, close quote. He wanted an American to occupy the Oregon country, to solidify under international law this claim to own this area. I will go through these very quickly. What right do Europeans and then later Americans claim they acquired by showing up? This is what Thomas Jefferson called it. This is what our founding fathers called this legal principle. They didn't use the phrase the doctrine of discovery. They called it preemption. Preemption, the right to be the only purchaser. The Indian tribes, the indigenous peoples, let's talk Africa, let's talk the Maoris, let's talk Australia, let's talk the Sami peoples up in the Arctic Circle, etc. Indigenous peoples were allegedly only able to sell their lands to the European country that had allegedly found them first. So this European Christian country acquired what the founding fathers knew as the right of preemption. Lots of cases talk about native title, Indian title here in the United States. What was the tribe left with? Well, you could use the land and you could occupy it. You ever want to sell it, guess what the rule of preemption means? You can only sell it to this European Christian country that allegedly possesses the right of preemption. Our very first Congress, folks, literally put this word in an act about the tribes to today is 25 U.S.C. Section 177. Still the law today, federal Indian law. No tribe can sell its land without the permission of the United States. And in 1790, July 22, when Congress passed the first act, they had the word preemption in there. So this principle was nothing new to Thomas Jefferson, nothing new to our founding fathers. And when Jefferson targeted Lewis and Clark at the mouth of the Columbia River, it was because he was attempting to claim the Oregon country for the United States under international law. Okay, I said, Jan hasn't come back. You know what she's doing? She's eating lunch right now. Bring me a plate. Oh, there she is. Bring me a plate. Okay. So I'm going to almost practically skip these because here's the bottom three that we... Hey, buy the book. You can read all this. That was a joke, but... Well, not a joke. You know, my dad owned a used car lot at 33rd and Southeast Powell for 52 years. I worked there 19 years before I went to college. So, yeah, come buy a book. I brought a couple. The three C's, I guess. Conquest. Now, all these elements I take from the Johnson v. McIntosh opinion. Maybe I didn't make that clear. After reading Johnson v. McIntosh 100 times, I saw these 10 themes, these 10 constituent elements of the doctrine of discovery. And it's these 10 themes that I argue prove that American Manifest Destiny is just a new name for the doctrine of discovery. What? Conquest. There's two meanings to this. It's a term of art, we in the law call it. Yes, military victory in war transfers property from the loser to the winner. That's been the law of war in Europe for 500 or 600 years. Commonly known, commonly discussed. But the law of war was not supposed to impact private property rights. But Europeans said by just war, by conquest in an actual physical battle, we acquire the tribe's lands. But the term of art, there's a secondary meaning to conquest that I perceive from Johnson v. McIntosh. When Europeans showed up, the flag and the cross, it was the same as if they had just conquered indigenous peoples. So that's why I say the title of this conference, The Gospel of Conquest, is perfect. Because merely by showing up somewhere, European Christians alleged it was as if they had conquered people. Ergo, the preemption right passed to the European that was the first discoverer. Wow. Okay, what was my last two C's? These are just to justify. Why should Europeans have this right? Usually I pick someone in the front row. Pat, where do you live? I'm coming over tonight with the Bob Miller flag and the Bob Miller religious symbol. And I want your house tomorrow. What's she going to do? 911. There's a crazy man at the front door. Or if we're in Arizona, you'd pull a gun. I've only seen one person carrying a gun in Arizona in 2.5 years. but it wasn't the ice cream store. I didn't know what he was afraid of. Anyway, so I'm gonna justify coming to your house, Pat, because I have a better religion than you do. And I'm going to come to your house and say, I'm more civilized than you are. You're a heathen savage. The way you live and what you eat and the way you dress is wrong. And I have some, God meant for me to have rights over you. Now, yes, she's calling 911, isn't she? But I'm talking the doctrine of discovery that is still the law today, folks. The U.S. Supreme Court cited Johnson v. McIntosh. I mean, it's a decade ago now, but in 2005, the Supreme Court cited Johnson v. McIntosh again, and federal courts cite Johnson v. McIntosh probably about every month. So we're not talking about something that's just old and, oh boy, that was bad then. We're talking about something that is still the law today and still based on these two false justifications. Christianity is not better than Indian religions. It has no rights just because you show up. Who's civilized? The people who come over here and kill all of us? Okay. So let's talk. I don't know what's next. Let's get. Oh, okay. I went too fast. I better look at my notes. When am I getting a plate of food? Oh, sure, sure. I've given this talk. Hey, I'm speaking tomorrow to 7th and 8th graders in 15 minutes. 15 minutes. 45 minutes. Okay. Well, I can slow down. So let me tell you. Okay. In the early 1400s, Spain and Portugal were developing the technology to sail outside the sight of land. As you can imagine, earlier people in boats stayed within sight of land. Spain and Portugal started going further. They start finding the Cape Verde Islands. They find the Canary Islands. And guess what? They want to acquire these things. Spain and Portugal begin to fight over the Canary Islands. Some Canary Islanders even get killed during the uproar. And then Portugal looks to the Pope. And in 1434, Portugal asks the Pope for a papal bull, granting King Duarte the right to control, civilize, and Christianize the Canary Islands. And at first, the Pope says, no, both of you stay away. You're causing trouble. Canary Island people are dying because of your conflict. Stay away. But now I want you to put yourself in the Pope's position, because King Duarte comes up with the winning argument, because he had good lawyers. He says, Pope, if you give me control over the Canary Islands, I will convert these people. I will add to the earthly flock of the one true religion. Now, you tell me what Pope can resist that argument. The Pope couldn't. In 1436, you get this papal bull, Romanus Pontifex, my Latin's any good, granting Portugal and Portugal only the right to settle, colonize, Christianize, and civilize the Canary Island people. King Duarte's used the same excuses you know from American history we used against Indian peoples. They're uncivilized, they aren't Christian, they have no money, they have no law, they have no clothes, they don't eat the food we do, they have no morals. All these same justifications that throughout American history we've used to call Indian peoples savages, uncivilized, is the same thing King Duarte said to try to justify being given this papal bull. So Portugal alone is given the right to colonize the Canary Islands. Subsequent decades, Portugal starts going down the west coast of Africa, and Portugal wants more rights in Africa. So they turn to the Pope again, and Pope Nicholas V extends Romanus Pontifex three times, 1452, 1453, and 1455. And I'm going to show you the language and let you read it. No reason for me to read it, but I have the pertinent language here from the papal bull of 1455. Does that look like the gospel of Christ to you? Conquer, acquire. Now, Saracens meant Muslim then. That was the word they used for Muslims, and pagans whatsoever. Acquire all their property, reduced into perpetual slavery, and you keep it, King of Portugal. So remember, Portugal was going down the west coast of Africa. And don't forget, they were sticking their flag everywhere they went, right? They left what were called stone pedroas, enormous stone monuments that said, this land is claimed for the king of Portugal. Ah, sort of like Lewis and Clark coming out here with the branding iron. Interesting. Okay, so Spain was left out of all this. And so when Columbus came to talk to Ferdinand and Isabella and said, I think I can go west and find new lands, they were very interested in him. Now, what'd you learn in your history? Wasn't he only going west for spices? Columbus ultimately signed 7 documents. I guess we dare call those contracts with Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. The word spices is mentioned in document 7. He was targeted at the Japans, they called it, China and the Japans. But you know what they told him? We will appoint you the admiral over any land you discover and acquire for us. His primary purpose in going west was to get away from Romanus Pontifex and Portugal's exclusive rights in Africa and the Canary Islands, etc. Go west, young man. I just never said that one before. That's a good one. Go west, find us land, and keep it. The moment Columbus lands on a couple islands, San Salvador, and Hispaniola, he rushes back to Spain, and guess what? They rush to the Pope. Interestingly, Pope Alexander VI was a Borgia. You may have heard that name. And he was only Pope because Isabella and Ferdinand had helped him become Pope. So now they go to him and they say, give us some papal bulls, grant us some rights in the New World. And you get Inter Catera Divinia in 1493. The Pope issues 4 papal bulls about these new Spanish discoveries in the West. And look what it says. Spain had the sole right to lands undiscovered by others. Wait a minute. Aren't the indigenous peoples living there? What'd you say? Hello. Yes. Well, thank you. Well, hello. No. They belonged to Spain, and any that had been discovered by Columbus, and any to be discovered if they have not been previously possessed by any Christian owner. So the presence there of indigenous peoples for thousands of years, indigenous cultures, indigenous religions, meaningless. Because only, apparently, did European Christians have rights to own land. Ah, what was the Founding Fathers' favorite scripture? Don't forget that. Okay, so where am I? Okay, so Portugal was a little unhappy with this new papal bull. Portugal and the Spanish knew, at least they perceived, that there was probably a great continent to the south of North America. Portugal wanted some rights there, and Portugal was also frightened, worried, that the line... Oh, I got ahead of myself. Okay, so the argument was that Portugal wasn't going to agree with this and wasn't going to cede to Spain the rights to the east. And so they asked the Pope for another papal bull. Did you like that effect? So he issues Inter Cetera II. And you can read that, I guess. So Alexander VI drew a line from the North Pole to the South Pole. How many of you knew they knew about the poles in 1493? Wasn't Columbus afraid of sailing off the edge of the... Were we taught something in school that was completely wrong? Apparently, because the Pope draws this line. The Portuguese were to have all rights to explore, conquer, and acquire sovereignty, jurisdiction, and title east of this line he drew, and the Spanish were to have the same right to explore, conquer, acquire sovereignty, jurisdiction, and title west of that line. So I got ahead of myself a little bit. Portugal was a little unhappy with this, where this line was drawn. And before I get too far, look at what the Pope said this order was about. The expansion of the Christian rule, this holy and laudable work. Wow, is that the Christian religion of today? Sounds a little different, but it's the justifications for the doctrine of discovery. So here's the line. Let me just take that back. Portugal was unhappy with the line that was drawn in 1493 because they said we don't get any of South America and we're worried about our trade routes sailing around Africa. So the very next year, Spain and Portugal signed the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494, and they moved the Pope's line about 500 miles to the west. So look at the line, folks. Wow, interesting. What language do they speak in Brazil? How'd that happen? How'd that happen? Look at the line the Pope drew. Now, and this is, remember, this is the line the Pope drew, and then the Spanish and the Portuguese agreed to move it further west because Portugal wanted a taste of South America. And also, to go back to my other point, where'd that go? I went the wrong way. Portugal was worried about sailing from Portugal. To get around Africa, you have to swing way out here, catch the trade winds, and go, woo! And so Portugal did not want Spain's rights to interfere with getting around Africa or not giving Portugal any right to South America. World history governed by church lines and the Pope, etc. Once Balboa crosses the Isthmus of Panama in 1513, once Magellan sails around South America in 1521, they find out there's this other big thing called the Pacific Ocean. Spain claimed it immediately. When Balboa crossed the Isthmus of Panama, folks, he engaged in all the doctrine of discovery rituals we can expect. Pulls out the sword, swishes around, cutting crosses in leaves, in the sand, on rocks. The priests are singing the Te Deums, which I don't know what that is, but I guess it's some religious song of the Catholic faith. I do not know what a Te Deum is. Wades out into the Pacific and claims it for Spain. And that's what Spanish claims to the entire Pacific Ocean were based on, folks, even up to here. Remember I told you when James Cook went up there? The Spanish tried to prevent him going there. And when James Cook landed three times in Alaska in 1778, raised the English flag, toast the king with some good British porter, and claimed it for England. 1778, the doctrine of discovery all around the world. Okay, so where was I? The Spanish were very legalistic. I wrote an article about Spain and their doctrine of discovery claims in Chile, and I was, didn't know much about Spain, was surprised to find how legalistic Spain was and perhaps still is today. A lot more law, probably, than we're used to in the United States or in our English Anglo-American system. The king was concerned about his conquests in the New World and whether he really did own the fee simple title because of the Spanish or the papal bulls. He organized a council in 1513 to draft regulations to control his conquistadors and how they made claims in the New World and what the rights of the indigenous peoples were. So there was no question Spain knew there were indigenous peoples, cultures, governments, nations, laws there already. They created in 1513 what's called the Requerimiento. When you hear this, you're going to just, your mouth, I think, will gape open. So the conquistadors were not to attack indigenous peoples until they carried out the legal requirements. They had to read them the Requerimiento. Was that in Latin? Was it in Spanish? You know what it said? God has given your land to Isabella and Ferdinand. You now need to change religions too, and you must become Christians or we will attack you. Discuss. Attack. The conquistadors literally became a joke. They would read it into their beard is the phrase. They would read it from the ship to the land at night. And they would say they had complied with the legal requirements. And in the morning, they'd attack and kill everyone. Now, how again, Pat, I'm coming to your house. Convert to the Bob Miller religion. And Bob Miller's your king. Else I might have to kill you. Ludicrous. So the idea of just war, the Spanish were very legalistic also about that. And look at this. Do you know what this means here? The phrase just war was put in the United States statute called the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. Now, that was under our Articles of Confederation Congress. This is not under our U.S. Constitutional Congress. So this was one government before the one we've got now. The Northwest that was being discussed was not this Pacific Northwest. It was what was called the Old Northwest, which is now the states of Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, I believe. So that Congress, and I think Jefferson wrote the first draft of this act because he was in the Congress in 1745, 17, 1775 and 76. It said, we will never take your rights without your consent, except in a just war. Who do you think defined what was a just war? But look where it came from. It came from this Spanish idea that was used across the world. Mexico, the Philippines, everywhere the Spanish went, amazingly, just war followed, and indigenous peoples lost out. So let's finish with the Spanish stuff pretty quickly. Franciscus de Victoria was a very important person in the international law regime. He's literally called by some people the father of international law. His writings on the indigenous peoples of the Americas is really the development of international law. He was a priest, he was a college professor, and an advisor to who now was Charles V of Spain, the Holy Roman Emperor, if you know that. So more than just the King of Spain, very important to Europe at large. The king was now in a dispute with the Pope, and the king did not want his title in the New World to be based only on the papal bulls. So Franciscus de Victoria comes up with novel new ideas. Indians are humans. They have a right to government and a right to property. Dominium. The word dominion. The dominions of Canada, etc., comes from this word dominium. The right to property and sovereignty. Franciscus de Victoria says the indigenous peoples have it. But the third most important issue is that they are bound by European international law and they have to give Spain certain rights or we can attack them. Just war. What were some of the rights? I think that's that Spain claimed. The indigenous peoples had to allow missionaries in and could not prevent them, else that was a reason for just war. And the indigenous peoples could not stop Spain from taking anything it wanted. Minerals, fish, timber, whatever. So you can see there were always just reasons to attack and take indigenous peoples' properties and lives. I think what came next, there was a great debate. You may have heard of Bartolomé de las Casas. He was appointed the king's representative for the indigenous peoples in the New World. And he came over here and was stunned at how the indigenous peoples were being massacred, destroyed, everything they had being taken, and they were being enslaved. So he returns to Spain. He raises a big ruckus about how the king's Christian, godly reign in the New World is what someone said earlier, genocide. And he and this other great legal scholar, Sepulveda, had a great debate whether American indigenous peoples were even humans. Sepulveda took the position they were not. He used the two Latin words. I know this much Latin. He said they were inculti, uncultivated, not civilized. But he said they were also inhumani, not human. So that was the debate they were still having in Spain in 1550. Portugal and Brazil, I wrote another article about how Portugal used the doctrine of discovery in Brazil. Very much an agreement with the church. The government was literally in charge of the church, and the church could only operate under government supervision, but what was the main purpose they claimed was conversion. Again, to help the savage, inhuman, incultai people in the New World. Okay, well, let me take that back before you read that. So, the New World, North America, well, we're mostly an English settlement, right? Settler society. You're probably thinking, Elizabeth I, she was Protestant. James I was Protestant. Why'd they comply with these papal bulls from the Catholic Church? Well, don't forget that Henry VII was still Catholic. And he was very concerned about violating the papal bulls, which, remember, divided the world just for Spain and Portugal. But Henry was also greedy. He wanted a little piece of that action in the New World, too. So John Cabot, you know that name, right? 1496 to 1498, Henry VII, a Catholic monarch, charters Cabot to sail west, look for lands, and he tells him, go where no Christian prince has yet been, and acquire for me sovereignty, jurisdiction, and title. So what does John Cabot do? from Nova Scotia, probably as far south as Virginia, row ashore every couple hundred miles, flag, cross, we'll be back. Flag, cross, we'll be back. So what was the... Okay, and so let me finish the story. So then by Elizabeth I, though, she's already excommunicated. She's Protestant. She doesn't care, one would think, about violating those papal bulls. I think I forgot to say that those papal bulls we talked about would excommunicate any other Christian king who interfered with Spain or Portugal's rights. So, yes, Henry VII was worried about being excommunicated, but his greed overcame his fear, I guess. John Cabot, just go where Spain and Portugal haven't yet been. I surely can't get in trouble for doing that. And again, his lawyers, the good guy, told him that. So that's our job. So, but what was the justification for the charters of colonization in the U.S., in what's now the U.S.? James I, Protestant. What did he say? The Indians live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the true God. So, here's what the colonists were ordered to do, right? Bring these infidels and savages to civility. That's that civilization excuse. Gee, King Duarte made that up in 1436. This is nothing new. And bring them to a settled and quiet government. English law at the time, 1606, very famous English case. Non-Christians were the enemies of Christianity. Sounds like just war. To be attacked. They are our enemies. This was in most of the charters that James I issued. For Jamestown in 1606, they got here in 1607. The New England colonies, Plymouth, Massachusetts Bay, etc., in the 1620s had identical charters. And here's a phrase I have to show you. It's almost too much. As Indians were dying from diseases that Europeans brought here, here's what the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony said in 1634. You know, if there's no Indians there, then it's available for us. It's empty. Wow. And I thought I had something. Well, the praying towns that were created. I don't know too much about the praying towns, but in New England, they almost look like reservations to me. But converge, or wrong word, segregate Christian Indians into these particular towns where they then were almost held there. Dress like Englishmen, be Christian, cut your hair, eat the kind of food Englishmen do. And even the Bible, John Eliot interpreted the Bible into Wampanoag in 1630, which I guess is the very first translation of the Bible into any Indian religion. So religion was part of the justification of what English were apparently bringing here to apparently help indigenous peoples. I'll skip that, but in my Indian law class, I only have 6 more minutes. You'll have to take my Indian law class. Religions were heavily involved. My own tribe, we were in the Ohio area. Quakers came, other religious leaders came to convert native peoples. Gosh, I guess a Methodist minister came here as early as 1834, right? Francis Lee came down the Mississippi, in the Willamette Valley. Jason Lee. Okay, what did I say? Francis Scott Key, come on. It's all just history. President Grant, in a dispute with the Congress in the 1870s, put religions in charge of reservations. He tried to put the army in charge for a while, and Congress stopped him, so he put religions in charge. I've seen in a book you can see every religion, or every reservation at that time, and what religion was assigned to them. And so maybe you go to some reservations, you go, wow, all I see is just one type of church. Huh, now you know why. Indian religious practices were outlawed. BIA, 1921. A famous circular outlawed the Indian dances. In Canada, the potlatches were outlawed. Here, the potlatches were restricted. I have never seen the federal law that outlawed potlatches in the U.S. If someone knows about it, tell me. I've never seen it. The boarding schools. My mom went to boarding school. Most of them were run by religions. Religious indoctrination went along with education in English and American values. And in fact, the churches were given, I thought I had one more slide, federal law gave churches land on reservations. gosh, wait a minute, wasn't that the tribal land? Wasn't that the Indian land? Why was that given to churches if they would run these various churches and schools, excuse me? Okay, well, let me look ahead. I'm nearly done. And then we have to give away one used book. Have you been thinking what the famous scripture is? Every bit of growth of the United States, folks, is based on the doctrine of discovery and can be explained by those 10 elements that I break the doctrine down into. So if you want to study this more, you got to buy a book. Okay. Africa. I started to write an article about Africa. I was going to focus on Kenya and Uganda to contrast how Germany and England settled in Africa, but I just never got back to it. Europeans divided Africa in 1885 at the Berlin Conference, primarily on two of my 10 elements, guess which ones, civilization and Christianity. So as recently as 1885, and so most of the borders of Africa are because of the European colonization and desires to acquire the great assets of Africa. Okay, manifest destiny. That's the big part of my book. What were Lewis and Clark doing? Why did Jefferson target them at the mouth of the Columbia River? He told them to go to the mouth of the Columbia River. It was because of the doctrine of discovery. But in 1845, the phrase manifest destiny was used by a New York newspaper man in two very important editorials in New York newspapers. First, he said, the U.S. owns Texas. And he wrote that in July of 1845. We own Texas. God meant us to have us, to have it. But then in December 27, 1845, he writes about the Oregon country. And he says, we already own it, but we deserve it because God said we deserve it. And God granted it to us because we'll do better with it than the English or anyone else. Oh, let me take you back. So when Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark to the Pacific Northwest, look who was already claiming the Oregon country. Great Britain, Russia, Spain, and the United States all claimed legal rights to this area. But it was time to solidify it by actual occupancy. We all were claiming first discovery claims to the Oregon country, but remember that second element of the doctrine of discovery? You have to actually occupy the area under international law to then have full recognized title. That's why Jefferson was so excited when John Jacob Astor said, I will build a port, a trading post at Astoria. What is manifest destiny? These next three points I'm going to show you is not my definition of manifest destiny. This is what historians tell you manifest destiny is. Americans have special virtues and institutions. We have a mission to remake the world in our image. And we're doing it under divine destiny. This is not the Bob Miller definition of manifest destiny. This is what historians tell you. I should have asked you all, when you hear the phrase manifest destiny, we all know it, but what does it mean? Well, here's what historians tell you it means. Jefferson believed this in 1803. He said, we are the people. Oh, wait till you hear this. He said, and it's a quote, we are the people that will nest all of North and South America. He thought Americans would take over all. Boy, thought he was a peace-loving, quiet little librarian. No. Okay, well, we aren't the only ones that had this idea of some kind of a destiny. Look at these other three countries in South America. This same idea that God intended European Christians to have it all. So that's really where we are. I mean, I am done, and we are going to go to lunch. I get the first place. The elders get to go first, right? No, I'm not done yet, because what is the favorite scripture? I have an answer. Oh, that's pretty good. Matthew, what was that? But isn't that in... Okay. Isn't that in the New Testament, the loving part of the Bible? Genesis what? There's a free book. Now... And I want you to see how good I am at animation. Watch this. Historians will tell you the founding fathers, and that's not just them, all the colonists. God intends the earth for farmers. God intends the earth for Christians. God intends the earth for us. Pat, I'm coming over tonight. Okay. Thank you very much.